Sexbomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
Voices, animal voices, the tremble of cold, the feminine abyss, and I'm reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Well, now I'll use a different voice because technical difficulties gave us a small start show ending in the beginning of a crunch.
But we'll come back to that at a time of a better convening. Tonight on the show, we have Marcus Abshire joining us. How's it going, Marcus?
It's going good. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's always good to have people on the show and chat and talk about stuff because stuff is important in life, isn't it?
Absolutely. Stuff makes the world go round sometimes.
Well, yeah, especially when it's loaded on the wrong side of the boat.
Yeah.
Then it just makes it go down.
Yeah, or in circles.
Yeah. Or, okay, so I'm going to throw this out at the beginning just because anybody who's followed the show on a regular basis or semi-regular basis know how much I hate this movie. And I don't normally hate things because I think hate puts out too much negativity out. But I have five movies that I have top dislike these movies so much. One of them is called Battleship.
Okay.
Have you seen this movie?
I have seen the movie, yes.
Okay. One of the reasons why I loathe this movie is because the ship that they're on, the 1940s battleship that they're floating through the ocean, and they decide to drop the anchor and try and do a Tokyo Drift.
Yeah, no, I remember. It's now, wonderful cinema. Yeah, I remember.
You know what will happen when that happens, right?
that chain's going to yank the bow of that boat into the water. The thing's probably going to break in half.
Break in half, go straight down, or snap the chain and bounce the boat back.
Yes, yes.
It is not going to do a side slide.
Listen, they just all got in the right spot so that the weight displacement was perfect for that maneuver.
Right. That's exactly what they did.
Yes,
yes. Yeah, but moving on.
Yes.
As much as I love to rag on that movie. Oh, and by the way, it's perfectly okay to swear if you so choose to do so.
Fucking A.
Fucking A, exactly. I usually let guests know about that before we start the show, but I forgot to mention it. My bad.
There's no problem.
So what is new and exciting in Marcus's land?
Well, I do have a new book release called Jericho. It's a horror Western. It's from Raventail Publishing and it's on the market and I'm really excited about it. And I'm thankful that you let me come on and talk about it a little bit.
Well, that's awesome. So I read a bit of a blurb on it. Oh, that's the wrong button. Don't press that button. That button's bad.
It was a bad button.
It was a bad button. I read a little bit of a blurb on it. It sounded fun. You've got a good positive ratings on Amazon already. That's awesome. When did it come out?
I think it's been about two or three weeks. It was one of the books that kind of have changed my tactics a little bit. I try to do a little bit more of a campaign to get some reviews early, get some ARC readers involved. And kind of do a little bit more promotion for it. So hopefully you get the reviews early and gets people interested in it, you know?
Yes. So speaking of that, I have a number of topics that I always talk about when I have guests on and talking about books and stuff like that. That one segues quite well into one of my favorite topics. That is the art of marketing. By the way, there's a GIF thing that you can do on the chat room. And apparently when you type in Abshire, I have no idea who any of these people are that pop up on there.
Let me try.
Yeah, it's just, it's a neat little chat room thing where you can pop a GIF in there. And it's just fun sometimes to accentuate a discussion. I frequently do it when I don't have a guest on and I'm just talking about random whatever the heck. Uh-oh, he's going to try and post a GIF. And is it GIF or GIF?
I didn't find anything I liked.
Oh, yeah, exactly. See? Right?
Yeah.
It's like sometimes it's not got any really cool things in there, but then sometimes there's a fun one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. But that's random. So
yeah.
I love random. Random is my key to life. So this book is about somebody named Ellie or Eli Knox.
It's about Eli Knox. The blurb kind of talks just a little bit about it. He was a captain in the American Civil or American Indian Wars. And he had his family was killed by the natives during the war, and he took it personal. So he went on a revenge campaign, you know, and he started doing a bunch of horrible things to the people that in the tribes that killed his family. So during that time, you know, he got a lot of blood on his hands. And then at one point he kind of realizes, hey, this isn't right. And so he asks for forgiveness, and he goes to the people and asks for forgiveness. And the natives, you know, decide to go ahead and give him forgiveness, but they want it to come with a price. And so they curse him with power that he has to use to kind of help balance out some of the evil he brought into the world. And so, you know, he kind of has to go around throughout the Old West and fight against some of the evil that's out there. And that's kind of, a little bit of the origin of who Eli Knox is. So at the base of it, he's a pretty horrible guy. That's one of the reasons why they like him, because they think that, and they know that he'll be able to do the hard work and the dirty work and the bloody work that needs to get done to fight the kind of evil that he has to go up against.
So, anti-hero guy, redemption story, / what the heck was that sort of thing?
Yeah, with a little bit of horror, or a whole lot of horror. And creepy monsters and spiders and women with open sores on their stomachs, and spiders live inside of them.
Okay, that sounds a little icky. It's the kind of stuff I watch.
It's great.
Yeah, good clean fun for everyone. Oh, wait.
Exactly.
Less on the clean, but still, good fun.
Good fun, yeah.
Yeah. When you visualize running a story like this, do you visualize it, or do you just run it through as you're writing it sort of thing? Like, do you think about it like a movie in your head?
You know, that's a great question, because it's more like a music video. So what happens for me is, if I get stuck on a scene, I usually have an idea. Let me go back. Over time, I've learned that I need to plot out my stories a little bit more, because I like to have them a little bit more complicated. And the more you plot, for me, it kind of helps keep everything straight, so that when I get to the end of the story, it's not a jumbled mess I have to fix a lot. It's pretty solid. But there are times where I get stuck on a scene or on how the story is going to turn and what's going to happen. And so what helps when I get writer's block like that is, I'll get in my truck and I'll go for a drive. Or if I'm just driving somewhere, I'll just turn on some heavy metal music, and I'll not think. I'll just have the idea of the story in the back of my head. And then I'll get visions, or just like, I will see, as if it's a music video, the scene play out to the music I'm listening to. And it'll just appear to me. And that'll be the inspiration of how I can get from one part of the book to the next in a really cool, action-packed, music video, rock and roll kind of way.
Nice. So a random spark leads to visualization, which then leads to an execution. Well,
that's right.
Not the execution, but as an execution of words on paper.
Yes. Yeah. So then it just kind of helps unlock the gate. So of the inspiration, you know, so I have the kind of the creative, you know, river can go, and I can keep going with where I'm at. And it helps connect, because a lot of times I'll have something that I've written in this chapter, and then I have to connect it to what I want to get to. And it's like, how do I weave that web from this place to the next when I don't have that yet? And that's where that'll come in. I'll go for a drive, and then I'll see those connections and how that can work. And then I'll get back and I'll get back to writing.
Now,
so it's kind of like a music video, not a movie.
Cool. Now, you go for a drive. Jack has asked something in the chat room about a Humvee. Do you drive a Humvee?
No. The Humvee was, I was in the Army back when I was a little lad, back in the olden days, when I was still young enough to do stuff like that. I was a 14 CS, where my MOS was. I was a 14 Sierra. So I did air defense. So I had the Avenger missile system that I operated, and I also would have the surface-to-air missiles that I could carry if we were assigned to a infantry unit or an infantry light infantry or mobile armored infantry.
Nice. Now I will have to ask, what does MOS stand for?
Or is it's like your job.
Something specialist.
Yeah, and it's
gotcha.
I think it's operate. I don't know. It's been a long time, but I know it's basically the your code for your job that you're given and what your unique training is for in the military.
Cool. Well, now you got a really interesting question in the chat room with a really interesting answer to it. So awesome.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Is that troll motherfucker? I appreciate that. Yeah, and thanks for the
that's Jack.
Book too. That's Jack. Okay. Well, thanks, Jack. Yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Don't worry, he'll ask lots of other questions too. Some of them will be meaningful.
you don't know if it's meaningful until it happens.
Oh, there you go. Military occupation specialty. I knew Jack would know exactly what that meant.
Thank you. There's so many acronyms in the military, and it's been so long. Some of them, you forget. But
dude, you should try working in computers. Oh, acronyms? No, thank you. So you can have an entire page discussing a complete thing, and it's like, is there a single word on this other than of, the, or that? No, it's all acronyms.
That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, well,
I like words. I like to write. I like words.
I get people sometimes. Actually, I get Microsoft's products when I'm typing correcting me because I use words that are too big for it.
Ah.
Because they have this in their grammar checking thing, the whole idea about what your target audience is for what you're writing, and if it's too smart, it tries to dumb you down. And it's like, I hate that shit, because it's like, I'm using the words that I want to use, and if I wanted to oversimplify it, I would do so.
Thanks for dumbing me down.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like, leave me alone. Let me use the word I want to use.
Yeah, so when I write, I just use a notepad, a text editor or whatever, and I just write it in RAW. And then I'll import it into a formatting program like Word or Scrivener or whatever, and then run the checking. Because not while I'm writing, man, because I will punch you.
That seems like labor intensive to me, though. You know, I just write into the Microsoft Word program, and it seems to, I don't know. I guess we all have our ways of doing it. Whatever way works, I guess, doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah, I'm a spiller. When I write, I spill it. I just like dump it all on the screen and say, okay, fine. I will then cut this later, cut that out, add this here, post that there, put it around.
I gotcha. Yeah,
fix it and post as it were.
Man, that just seems chaotic to me, but to each their own.
If you've ever seen some of my posts on Facebook, they're very chaotic.
You just dump it all out there.
I love chaos. Chaos is the spice of love. It is. That's life in another language. We won't go there, though. So that Ben beggared the next question there, pantsing or plotting, right? You already said you're plotting. Like, do you heavy plot, light plot, or anything along those lines?
I guess I'm like I'm a hybrid plotter. So I have, I usually have either an opening, that I want to get because I want to grab attention, because in this world it seems like with attention spans you got to try to write the first chapter that grips people, or else you run the risk of them putting the book down. So I really have kind of an idea of what I want to try to do at the very beginning of the book in the first chapter, and then I have a general sense of where I kind of want it to go, but usually I have the beginning and the end kind of plotted out. And then if there's any sort of unique plot details or plot twists that I want to add in, those usually come as I'm writing it. But I might have an idea for what I want near the end of the book, but I get the idea near the beginning as I'm writing it. So I tend to plot that out and put those down as they come to me. And then all the kind of blank space in the story, I just pants that out and let it come as it comes, just let it happen. And then hopefully at the end of it, I've got it all figured out.
Cool. So a bookend plotter.
Yes.
Nice.
I'm a pluck otter.
There you go. Yes. Oh, wait. Do you know what a plotter is? Not plotting? Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I think they're the ones that plot out the story kind of detailed-oriented, right?
Yeah, well, you have the guy who will just keep writing, and doesn't actually have a direction, so he's plotting through it. So P-L-O-D-D as opposed to P-L-O-T-T, yes. Plotting it out. Yes. So yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but...
That's okay. You know, I sometimes think I need to plod more, because I find it like some of my chapters are pretty short, because I have an idea of kind of that in the back of my head. I have this sort of time limit of how much I should be writing and when the chapter should end. And so sometimes I think I need to plod a little bit more, I think.
Well, that's cool. So I like that approach. I've never actually considered doing it as like a bookend plot. It's actually pretty a neat idea. I mean, if you know how it starts and you know how it ends, and then most of the stuff in the middle is just what you're trying to get to, I could see that working.
Yeah, yeah. I find it really helps too to kind of discover the characters along the way. The plot points are important to me because I need the plot for structure to keep me focused, but the characters and how they grow and change and interact is more organic throughout the story, which allows them to kind of develop naturally and become something that I think people can really understand and kind of bite into, you know? So I feel like the plot is a structured reality that needs to be adhered to, but the people and the characters and the monsters and the creatures are not, they're unpredictable. And so I let that happen without any real structure in a sense, so that it feels like this could be real. It just kind of, I feel like it helps grab the essence of those characters that I'm trying to write if I don't try to force it.
Nice. And do you pick when I'm reading or when I'm writing, either way, when I'm dealing with a character, I have a voice in my head that I identify with that person based on whatever random elements as far as I've gotten to that point or whatever. And as I did in the fake start that we started here with the Skeksis voice, which is pretty much the only voice I can do now, I will sometimes have a voice like that in my head that is talking the lines of whichever that character is doing. Is that,
you know,
similar?
Yes, I definitely have that. I think it's more pronounced for specific characters that have a much more, like the Skeksis characters are these, you know, horribly evil bird-looking things that have that shrill voice, you know, and it's very unique to them and it fits with what they are. When you have like a standout character like that or a bad guy or something, then it's a little bit more pronounced for me. But it doesn't always come across for me as a specific, say, voice I hear, but more of like a tone of what that thing should sound like or would say, you know, more of like the pronunciation of the words, the choosing of the words, how the sentence would flow. And so there's a character in this book that has three mouths, and it has one on each side of its face where the cheeks are, and then the one in the middle, and then it has four eyes, so that it would turn its head and two eyes, the temple eye and the regular eye, would line up with the mouth on the side of its face. And it's almost like a three faced monster that, depending on which side of the face is looking at you, you get a different personality. And and in that sense, I had to really, I found the voices for each one because they're different and they represent sort of a different sort of evil crazy. You got, you know, like chaotic evil, you're just like psychopathic, just not, you can't understand it, evil. And then more like your methodical sort of intelligent evil. And so each one of those did definitely have a specific voice that I could hear as I was writing it.
Nice. I was going to do air quotes and quasi evil.
Yeah, Austin Powers.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that character was a demon of some sort because, you know.
Yeah, it's a. So I like the idea of Lovecraftian evil.
Cool.
I really get into the. I think the things that scare me the most for me are the unknown horror. And, you know, there's a lot of horror that is sort of personified in a way that you can understand it almost. Like serial killers are at least human.
Somewhat.
Even like somewhat, right. You know, Troll, you're right. It's kind of like, I just saw his chat, but it did kind of remind me almost of the Fates or the kind of mm-hmm. universal, you know, three-sided sort of face of humanity, I guess, with that character. But anyway.
My high school took us to watch that at the theater. Who did that? Roman Polanski's Macbeth. And that scene with the witches has always stayed with me. I was like, that's some nasty shit. That one's naked. You brought us a bunch of 15-year-olds into a movie. Watch this stuff. I was like, we love it, but were you sure about this? That was
that
part
sort
of English class.
That sticks with you, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had fun in school, so it's like, I don't really mind it for the most part, but I understand some people have different experiences. As the expression goes, mileage will vary.
Yeah. So anyway, I like the Lovecraftian horrors, and so that character is kind of the main bad guy, in a sense, and so it kind of embodies sort of a horror that you can't really comprehend, you know.
Cool. So do you gravitate to a lot of Lovecraftian stuff? Like Cthulhu and Dagon and whatever else?
Yeah, I think my fascination with it is really just in the Eldritch horrors, just like the nameless gods, sort of the idea of the endless sleeper of this being that's so ancient and powerful and so it's just been sleeping for forever. And you never want it to even wake up because just its focused consciousness is enough to like obliterate your sanity from, you know, wherever in the cosmos it's sleeping. So I just think that sort of stuff is terrifying. And so I just write about it. It helps me sleep at night.
Cool. So you have like the two extremes. The, hey, I'm going to explain everything about why this is evil. Look at that horn. Look at the blood dropping off that horn. He's going to gore that person and tear them a new one. And then the other side is like, I don't know what it was. I just feel dread. I feel fear. Yeah. I feel waves of chaos just emanating from this thing.
Yes. And I tend to like to merge those a little bit. So what you'll have is you'll have an evil or a bad guy that you can kind of describe as somewhat solid, but the essence and the power and the evil behind it is that sort of undescribable, unfathomable, unrecognizable evil that it just doesn't sit right with reality.
Yeah. I would normally call it like the greasy stain on an observable experiences.
Yeah.
Because it's I get what where, and I like Lovecraft. I've read a lot. And I get what the attempt was with what he was doing with that. And it's like, did you just run out of words? Was that why you did that? But then, yeah. No, it's cool. I mean, I like stuff like that. I mean, I've always gravitated to it. I mean, I watch horror movies and I laugh at them.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the right reasons.
I do tend to try to mix it so that there's a definitive bad guy that you can kind of recognize and understand, but there's also that element of just chaotic unknown horror that you're just like,
cool. Random. We already expressed that we love that stuff.
We do. We love it.
So do you spend a lot of time building the world you're working with, or do you just, like you mentioned earlier, the bookend plotting? where all the stuff gets filled in the middle. Does the world building part of that happen while you're in the middle, or does it happen before and outside of the actual writing process?
I think it depends on the story and where it takes place and what the setting is. Like the last time I was on, we talked about one of my book series, Ways of the Warlock, and you know the world itself is already established. It's an urban fantasy. It takes place in the modern world, but the magic and the systems involved had to be kind of flushed out. So in that sense, I try to flush that out beforehand, because in all of my stories, I want to limit the good guys' power so that they don't have just a get out of free jail card because they have, you know, some sort of magic gimmick that allows them to beat any enemy. So I have to put a limiter on sort of the structure and the reality of their power. And so in that sense, you have to kind of think that out, so that you don't start writing and you realize you've created a character who's basically has all these little tricks and is immortal and unbeatable. And now you've lost all sense of, you know, there's no stakes. You just know that the main character's got a way out of everything.
That's why I never liked Superman.
Yes. You know, I just got done having a conversation with somebody about Superman versus Batman and how it's hard to write a Superman, because how are you going to put him in danger? Like, exactly. What are you going to do? You gotta kidnap his girlfriend or hit him with a crystal, you know, some kryptonite. It's like,
so the best Superman, there's two good Superman stories I've ever read. And one of them has the Superman's girlfriend being kidnapped. I don't know if you've ever read Injustice.
I've read some of it, yes.
Okay, so the beginning of it is pretty gruesome. Having the Joker convince Superman to attack Lois Lane and kill her, and he loses his shit.
Yeah, yeah.
First season of that was fantastic. And then after everything else, it got a little derivative and then got some good points and bad points or whatever. But that's exactly it. He's unkillable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and he's got so much power and so much everything that and the reason why that I think that story was a good one, and I agree with you, that was one of the best ones, was that you didn't attack his power, you corrupted him. Right?
Yeah. You made him the bad guy.
Yeah, you kind of turned him into the bad guy, and so that's the only way to kind of beat him, really. But so in that sense, I do have to do some world, but now with this book with Jericho, there was a little bit of world building, not a whole lot, but it's the Old West, so it's a Western horror. So, you know, the biggest thing was making sure that what I was writing was pretty accurate to the time period, so that I wasn't putting elements in that didn't exist or wouldn't make sense. And then, you know, all of my protagonists have some sort of power or magic or something that they have. I love writing that, so that allows them to sort of have a way to fight back. I guess I'm just a big fan of that, and I write that in almost all of my stories. So in that sense, you have to still figure out what the dynamics are, what the structure is for that power, and then how to limit it. So he wields dual pistols, and because of his curse, he has to sacrifice blood every time he uses his magic. And so what happens is whenever he needs or he wills his magic to activate, his pistols will glow and emerald light, and needles will pierce the palms of his hand and they'll draw blood. And so if he uses it too much, it'll take too much blood and weaken him and you know, eventually kill him. So he can use a lot of power. He just has to balance that because it takes a heavy toll. So he's got to be smart. He's got to be, you know, methodical. He's got to understand that balance so he doesn't overdo it, shoot a cannon out of his pistols, and then dies. So, you know, he's got to be strategic, which I thought was fun to write.
Nice. Yeah. No, that's actually, this is a thing that I have noticed in some of the things that I read from various places. If you make them too powerful, the only way to offset that is to have something else more powerful. And at a certain point, what do you get? You get a person versus the universe, and then the universe is always going to be ultimately more powerful than you. Yeah. But then if you're more powerful than the universe and that's how the story ends, now you just bored the shit out of me.
Right. You've basically entered into a story that's not even, it's not even, you can't even associate with it. Like, you can't find anything to be interested in. I completely agree. You can't keep leveling up and eventually just level up into godhood, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem with Superman all the time. It's like, level up, level up, level up, and then, oh, kill him, send him to hell, and then he comes back as something else weird, and then he comes back as himself. And then you almost kill him again several times, and okay, whatever.
I think there was one he came back as, like, he had energy powers or something. I don't know. It was, it was wild.
Death of Superman led to the Red Superman, the Blue Superman, Steel, the Cyborg Superman, and I think there was a fifth one. And the whole idea was to experiment, and this is what DC was doing. They were experimenting with the product line to see which one would work well, and they eventually had to kill all of them and return back to the original Superman and sort of keep Steel kicking around every once in a while.
Because
Steel actually looked cool, but that was about the end of it. He had a big hammer.
Yeah, well, he's in that Lois, the I guess the show on, is it on HBO or Max?
Wait, Steel showed up in the new show?
Yeah, Steel's really? In it. He's in a lot of those episodes. He's running around fighting with them. Yeah, he sure is.
Okay.
And in that story, in that show, he's had two boys, and they both have powers. They both have Superman powers.
Huh. Okay.
I heard it's rated pretty good, so it's a pretty good show.
I haven't seen any of it yet. I just haven't had the time to watch it.
I hear you.
Plus, with the plethora of other things to watch.
Yeah. You got to pick and choose. You only have so much time, you know?
Exactly. So, when you're designing some of this stuff, like this world, these characters, and these people and whatever, are you, sorry, let's use the polite word, taking inspiration or borrowing from other sources?
Well, you know, I always am afraid of being, you know, like an imposter or not having, you know, your own ideas. But the way I see it is almost every idea out there has been done. I mean, it's really hard to come up with something really unique. And even when you do, it still has a connection to other things. And so I think the best thing you can do is just what I do. Is I just write. So most of my stories, I stayed away from spiders because I was like, you know, spiders have been done to death. They're creepy. Yeah, everyone knows spiders. This, you know, Stephen King's It thing was a spider at the end. It's like, you know, but then I just was like, you know what? They're freaking creepy for a reason.
And yeah.
And when I write it, as long as I write it in the way that I think it should be written, it's going to be unique in my own way.
Yes.
So as long as I'm not intentionally saying, oh, I'm writing this to look like this other thing because I like that thing. Instead, I'm like, I'm writing this because I think this personally looks creepy or this works or whatever. Then it's always going to have my own trademark. You know what I mean? Like, it's always going to be my own unique sort of take on it. So in this book, I embraced the spiders and I did it in a way that I thought was that I just enjoyed and that I liked. And like I said, some of the creatures in this book are women that have been kind of taken, and they have these large sort of open wounds on their stomach, and it oozes pus because it never heals. But inside are thousands of red spiders that they can kind of send out if they need to do whatever they need to do, either kill someone, poison, whatever. So they've got like this little spider army living inside them. And I don't know if anybody else has ever done that, but I thought it was freaking cool, and I did it, and I loved it.
And ultimately speaking, that's all that should really matter.
I agree.
But I did see something that did have something similar.
Well, there you go. See? And
it was the movie adaptation of Lost in Space with what the heck was his name? Mimi Rogers was the mom.
Damn it. I've only seen clips of that. Was it Tim Allen? No, not Tim Allen.
Not Tim Allen. It's one of the guys from Friends. It's like, hey, hi, how you doing? That guy.
Matt LeBlanc
was basically the hero throughout the whole thing. And the two girls who were the daughters of Mimi Rogers and the other guy, they became famous for other stuff. I can't remember. I'm sure Jack will throw it up in the chat room. But yeah, there's a scene in there where Mr. Smith ends up bursting with a whole army of spiders coming out of his stomach. Oh, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen it.
You know, it's interesting. I have actually never seen that. So it goes to show that even when you think you're doing something original, somebody else has probably done something similar already. But, you know, what are you going to do? Now, did that person die when those spiders busted out of them?
Not really, but okay. It wasn't his choice for those things. Okay. But okay. I think eventually the idea was that he would become responsible and in choice for them and rolling and controlling them or whatever. William Hurt, right. That was one of the guys. Sorry. Jack is cursing me out in the chat room again because I'm probably making him spend money on something. Which, fine, I am evil. It's what I do. I have a comic shop. It's part of the game plan, right? Sell people stuff. Not a single thing in my comic shop is something anybody needs. It's all about want. It's all about want.
And nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, and like we were about to say, as we're talking about stories and whatever, there's approximately 10,000 books released in North America every year. Wow. Out of those 10,000 books, maybe a couple of hundred get converted into movies or TV shows or whatever. But there is approximately in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror genres about, I think it's about 1,200 or 1,300 different projects released every year. And at some point, statistically speaking, every single idea of a story is going to be touched upon at least once by somebody. It's statistics. There's no way around it.
There's no way around it. But and that's why I don't worry about it, honestly. And I just feel like if I do it the way that I want to do it, it'll have my own fingerprint on it. And
yeah,
I feel like somebody will like that take, you know? At least I hope.
Well, think about kaijus, giant monsters, Godzilla. Yes. He's the epitome of it. But there's like thousands of different variations of giant monsters scrolling around Japan going bam, 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 bam. Yep. There's an entire industry on it. Yep. Hell, Power Rangers was every episode had a new one.
Yep. And every time someone does it, it's a little bit different. And you can like the big sort of, you know, Godzilla ones that come up from the earth, from, you know, nuclear bombs, and they have the movies. Is it kaiju? The kaiju, is that the,
what's kaiju, the name of
those movies?
Yeah, yeah. Kaiju and is the general term for giant monsters.
Yeah, but there was a movie where they had the big robotic kind of Robotech guys fighting the kaiju.
Oh, Pacific Rim. They were Jaegers. They were Jaegers.
Yeah, right. The Jaegers, that's right. So you had your Jaegers. So that was a different take on it, you know. They kind of came from a portal. But you're right, you know, just it's the same idea. There's so many different ways of doing it. You just got to find your niche and just hope somebody else likes it.
And did you know that Pacific Rim was actually supposed to start out as a Lovecraftian horror?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it was heavily modified from his original idea, and then it grew into that.
You know, I like the movie because I'm really into sort of that dichotomy between, you know, the robotic sort of technology against sort of the monster. But I would have really liked to have seen that one with the Lovecraftian horror against, I don't know, the big robot.
Yes. I guess. But I think from what I understood, he was, let's say, convinced to go a different route because Lovecraftian horror is not appealing to a wide audience, and they were investing millions and they wanted big returns.
Ah, yeah. Well, such is life, right? That's yes. kind of the way it goes sometimes.
Now, did you ever see The Color Out of Space with Nicolas Cage?
No, I haven't.
Oh. This is a Lovecraftian story. It's awesomely well done.
The Color Out of Space?
The Color Out of Space.
So, do you say like Colorado or the
color? No, color as in C-O-L, or for you Americans, C-O-L-O-R. Like the color purple, right?
Okay.
But it's actually a really well done Lovecraftian story.
Oh, Color Out of Space, yeah.
Yeah. Which I think that was the name of a Lovecraft story as well.
Oh, I've got this one queued up on my Prime Video. I was looking at it the other day. I saw the cover. Yeah.
It's awesome.
I haven't watched it yet, but I've got it on my
okay,
my
no
list.
Spoilers.
Okay, don't spoil it. I'll watch it. I'll watch it this weekend.
So over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years or whatever, Cage has come out with some really good, serious, solid horror and action type movies. This is one of them.
All right.
Another one's called... what the hell was it? Oh, man. I can't remember. But there's a handful of them that just came out during that time period, which they're pretty cool. And then, of course, then he does the movie Jiu-Jitsu, which is stupid as shit. It's like, imagine Nick Cage being one of the Mortal Kombat guys, and it's like,
Oh
my God, that was bad, brutal.
Yeah, I think I saw the trailer for that, and I said, no, I'm good.
I watched the movie.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. I watch bad movies.
Well,
I watch
a
lot of bad movies.
You're dedicated to that.
Well, it looked funny. And
yeah,
it was
the
funny
other one,
looking.
The other one was a Void. Have you watched the movie Void?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, so it's one of those sort of Lovecrafty, and they open a portal, and this thing comes out and starts terrorizing the town. But that was another one. I've got two of them that are on my to watch list, and that Color of Out of Space was one of them. So, well, I'll have to watch it this weekend then.
I'm probably spelling Void wrong. Oh, The Void.
Void, yeah. V-O-I-D.
Yeah, no, that is a good one. That's a good creepy one.
Yeah,
that one I've seen.
I was like, ooh, I've got to do that one too. I started it the other day, but something came up. I had to stop. But that was definitely one that's going to be watched.
That one relies on a lot of not explaining things. And it does
it really well.
Like, it does that whole, here's a horror thing, but we're not going to tell you what it is. And it's
going
to be creepy as shit.
You know, I feel like the stuff you can come up with in your mind that fills in the gaps that they don't give you
is
scarier than, you know, if they try to overly explain it.
Yeah, and I was right. This one was done in Canada. It was filmed in Sault Ste. Marie.
Was a Void was done in Canada?
The Void, yeah, The
color?
Void.
Okay.
Yeah, because I did enjoy that movie. One of the things I really liked about the movie is, like, there's almost no CG.
Yeah.
Like, it's all practical effects.
Well, that's good. I love practical effects, especially if they're done right. I mean, and nowadays they have really good technology for that stuff. They don't always have to do the CGI.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Army of Darkness and the Evil Dead trilogy.
Oh, my God. That's my favorite trilogy. That's my favorite horror.
Exactly.
Well, the first two were amazing in their low money and production that they had. And they still were able to knock out these creepy as hell, scary movies. And I like just that weirdness and kind of comedy edge to them. And then in the third one, they just went full on. And I love that because I like the comedy aspect too. So it was, that was my favorites.
Yeah. Did you watch the show as well?
I watched a couple seasons of the show, but I did start watching the show. But like you said, it's hard to pick time to dedicate because there's so many things out there. But I did watch, I think, the first season, and that was there's so many good things.
Ash vs. Evil Dead, the show, each season gets grosser and more over the top each season.
It doesn't surprise me. Now, I watched the first season, and I don't know if I can tell the spoiler, but it was such an Ash ending where he's just like, he just takes the deal, he's good to go.
Yep.
Oh, and then, it's so ad.
They introduced Lee Majors as his dad and was like, this is perfect casting. That's character, great. Awesome. Look, totally.
It was great, yeah.
Yeah, man, it's like, I love that shit.
Yeah, me too.
I love so many weird things. And that's one of the reasons why I do this show, is to be able to talk about them and express and share them with other people so that they can enjoy them too.
Spread the love.
Spread the love. Or infect the planet. Either one's good.
Infect the masses.
Yeah. Well, I don't... Have you ever seen a movie called Hackers?
Yeah, I have seen that one. Yeah,
that was the one buzz line in the whole thing, is infect the planet.
Infect the planet.
Oh, man, now I feel like watching that. Damn it. Yeah, okay. Back to the book. So, Jericho. Yes. And speaking of which, I'm a big fan of the whole... See how I shift gears like this? Talking about promoting and marketing about stuff like that, because that's a very important part of it. And one of the things I noticed with some writers is that because writing more nowadays is a solitary thing, the companies you work with or that produce your product don't do as much of the marketing and selling it of it as you, the individual, do. Now, it sounds like you have a good grasp on this. How much marketing do you do for your book?
Well, I the problem with marketing is that a lot of it entails revenue and investment. And so if you don't have the infrastructure in place in order to get the book out into a lot of people's faces, is to kind of force it through advertisement, or, you know, basically just finding a way to get it advertised to the right people, which costs money and know-how. So it becomes difficult if you're not making a lot of money off of it yet. You got to have the investment on it. So that could be a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I have gotten a lot better with it. Like with this book, I spent quite a bit of time with something new that I hadn't done before. And I feel like an idiot because I've written and either self-published or had published up to about 15 books. And so I feel like, you know, I should have been better at this, but we all learn at our own pace, I suppose.
It's a game as much as anything else.
Yeah. And, you know, and life itself makes it hard sometimes. You know, I don't care what they say. Success can come at any time, but it also has to fit, you know, because, like, it's hard. If your life is chaotic and it's tough and you got a lot of things going on, it's hard to dedicate the time you need to to what you need to do. But anyway, so in this one, I looked into and began doing ARC readers, which was really instrumental in getting a lot of early reviews. Now, I was a little disappointed because when I first threw it out there for the ARC reader community, you know, I had like almost 20 to 30 people that committed to do it. And out of that group, I didn't get as many people. They read the book for free, but they didn't follow through. So I think as an ARC, yeah, if you're going to do an ARC campaign and get ARC readers, you almost have to be kind of interviewee and weed out and kind of get commitments so that people will actually write the review after they've read it and after the book comes out, because that, I think that's helpful. I mean, it can take a while if you don't have, you know, a huge fan base to get the reviews. And with Amazon, your algorithmic reach will change based on how many reviews you get.
Yeah, definitely.
So getting reviews is super important. And so I tried with this one with that. I got more reviews early on than I had in any other book, but it, you know, it's still one of those things where it's like you need more and more. And, you know, honestly, if you don't have a publisher or the infrastructure or investment capital, it's hard. You know, you're just out there, you're out there pounding the pavement. You're trying to get friends to do it. You're trying to talk people into it that you see. I go to book conventions. I do a lot of, I'm doing a thing this Saturday, and it's like a book fair
Where you're doing a live radio show?
You do exactly. Do the live radio show. I just did a podcast on Monday or the other day. So, you know, you just got to be out there doing all kinds of things and trying to get out to as many people as possible and just get the word out. And it's hard, but, you know, we'll see. You know, this is the first book that I had so many different options, because over time, when I did this radio program with you last time, you know, you were like, it was like the only thing I knew. But as you do it, you make connections with people,
yeah.
You get introduced, and you can grow. And so the next time you release one, now you have five places that you can go instead of one. And then that leads to 10 places. And then before you know it, you have this whole thing, hopefully, of places and people that you can help get the word out.
Yeah, and that's the thing I say about everything. It's like, if you want to succeed at it, make friends. Friends exactly. will help you grow, because A, one thing, they'll drive you, and two, another thing, they'll help you. And it's yeah. not necessarily something that they're doing deliberately. It's just the association alone sometimes build those connections, like you were talking about. And yeah. with the type of promotional stream you were talking about there, it really falls down to what I would call the quality versus quantity statement. You either get hundreds of ARC readers and wait to get back 10% return on that, or you weed out, as you were saying, and just find people who you can feel comfortable that will do it in a higher percentage.
Yes, and you want people to be excited about it, because I have found that you get far more attention if, let's say, you know, I get 100 people and they all review it, but then I post a book on, say, a Facebook page or somewhere, and nobody talks about it. But if you yeah. get five people that really were into it, and then you post a small little advertisement, and then you get people talking about it, that brings in other people, because when people see other people talking about it, it's so much better than when you just post it and get one like.
It's the blurbs.
Yes.
Not to be confused with the burbs, because that was a whole different set of movies.
That's a totally different scenario.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Absolutely. And like I said, I've known a lot of writers in my time, and I've witnessed some who do extraordinarily well, and then some who just, like, they keep plodding along. One of the things I always notice about conventions is, like, the guy or girl who are there trying to sell their book, and they're very excited about their product, but they sit behind the table and they just don't pay attention to try to outreach to people. And then you got people like me who will say, hey, how the hell are you? Come over here and let me talk to you. And yeah. that's at a convention how you sell. Because otherwise, I mean, okay, so Fan Expo will be here in August, and that's a huge convention. They get like, what, 140,000 people in the doors at that show? Yeah, just a couple. It's two huge buildings, and the people there are looking for whatever thing that those people are looking for, and if you're trying to catch their attention and be different and unique, you have to stand out. And one of the things that's most standoutable that I've found is being friendly.
Yeah.
Talking to people, yeah. being nice, engaging people. Uh-huh. Not necessarily yeah. just trying to bang them in the head saying, buy my book, which I yeah. think is funny when people try that, but it's a hard thing to master. It really is.
Yeah, especially when you feel like, a lot of times, I've done a few of those, a lot of those book things, and you feel like, you know, someone comes by and they look at it, and you're almost like pressured in trying to sell it. But, you know, if they do talk about the book, then you talk about the book. But I've had a lot of times where they come up and they're interested in the book for a minute, but then we just start talking. They'll say something about the cover, yeah. which leads into a conversation about art. And then we start talking about digital art and different things. And before you know it, I'm just having a conversation with somebody and having a good time. It may not lead to a sale, but it doesn't matter, because you don't know where that's going to lead down the road. You know,
exactly.
That person and you're talking, yeah.
That person could talk to somebody else. Like, I talked to this really cool guy over there, and then two, three other people come over and talk to you, and I actually may buy the book. Like, coming onto this show is pretty much, I think, convinced Jack to buy some of your book, because that's why I'm evil. He does that. and that's one of the things why I do the show as well, because I like to do that. I like to experience new things and find people who talk about things. And for my show, I don't have a script. Like, I don't have a specific objective to say, I need this, and this to be mentioned, talked about, conversed, whatever. And I've told many guests who have come on here, it's like, if you don't want to talk about a lot of stuff, just answer the questions I throw at you. I will carry the conversation. Because my regular show here for an hour is me it's talking about stuff.
Yeah, you could do that all day, can't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like the interaction. I like, you know, it's like when I was in school, I didn't like online classes because I didn't get the interaction with the professor. And so I liked having the back and forth with people because then it was just better. You know, you play off each other. It makes it better. I don't know. The whole thing is better that way.
Yeah. Like many of the conversations I've had with people on this show, it starts with something basic and then it's exploration of a variety of things. But there's no script. There's no script driving it. Not a single one of my shows falls into the same, hey, what's your favorite color? Yeah. How do you do this with the sink? Do you actually wash your dishes afterward? No, I don't care about any of that shit. Some of it's sometimes interesting if it starts a conversation, but it can't be the whole thing. So always like organic discussion that could go in any of three different directions at any one time. Apparently Hunter Thompson has a kitchen.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know. Jack throws weird things in the chat room sometimes.
Okay, weird is good, right?
Yeah, weird's awesome. So we got a couple minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like promote? Where do people find your book other than Amazon?
Well, right now, Amazon is probably the number one place. You can always connect with me. I have a website. Under my name, Marcus Abshire. It's a Wix site, but if you just Google Marcus Abshire, you'll find all the things that you would need to connect with me. I've got a duology, a horror series. It's a completed duology about two teenage girls who live on a lake town and just graduated high school, and they kind of have to fight off a creature from another dimension. It's got a lot of Stranger Things vibes to it, I think. But it was done my first foray into horror. So that was an interesting one. And then there's always, you know, the Ways of the Warlock series that I talked about last time I was on here. And then I've got a bunch of self-published books. I've got Werewolves versus Vampires. I've got,
because everybody loves both of those things.
I've got a supernatural or a special forces trained combat wizard that fights against his own government and against cyborgs that have been made to kill him. I've got, what else we got? Oh, there's a Lost City of Atlantis. So there's an outcast Atlantean who lives on the surface with his pet dog, Neil, who's
Sounds like Aquaman?
Yeah, kind of.
Sorry, I had to throw that in.
There's not a lot of Atlantean stories. Most people only know of Aquaman because Atlantis doesn't have a lot of those kind of, I don't know, it's one that's not really done to death, I think.
There's a few out there, but yeah, you're right. They're not, it's not a heavily plastered.
No, it's not. And then, what else do I got? Oh, there's a, Shadow Magic. It's a shifter novel. And so the difference between shifter and the werewolf versus vampire is like the werewolves are kind of shifting to wolves only, but the shifters are different types of animals. And so, I've got one where that was actually a pretty good one. It's got a lot of characters in it. And let me think. Oh, I've got a Santa versus Zombie Apocalypse. I think we talked about that last time. I wrote that for my daughter. That's a kid's story.
As it should be. As it should be.
And I can't think of anything else right off the top of my head.
Oh, that's good. That's all awesome. So what are the socials you're on?
I'm on Amazon. I got Facebook page. It's under Marcus Abshire Author. I do have a TikTok, but... that TikTok thing is just, I'm too old for that, I think. But other than that, those are the main places you can find me. I do have some books published through Raventail Publishing, and they've got some Facebook pages, and they've got some things that you can connect with. And if you like my stuff, they've got a whole ton of authors out there that you can kind of, if you're interested in horror, you can take a look at other authors and see what they have to offer. But that's a big publishing company that has a lot of horror options available.
I have had a couple of their authors on the show. So are they a good company to deal with? Like, they're respectful, responsive?
You know, yeah, they are. You know, I think initially they were still trying to get their footing. They're kind of like a new imprint from a larger publishing company of the Western, which is why I did a horror Western, because I was like, let's merge the two things into one.
Cool.
You know, they're very patient with me, because it takes me a while now to write because of my situation and, you know, raising my daughter alone and a lot of other things that are happening. So it's hard for me to find time to, you know, write. And so they're very patient, you know, but as a writer, you always want them to do more promotion for you. You always want them to do more to get your book out there. But, you know, it's going. I don't know. I don't have a lot of experience. I don't know what to expect. But overall, yeah, I like writing for them. Everything that I have a concern, they address. You know, everything goes pretty smoothly, and once you get the book done, it gets out pretty quick. So,
yeah, you hear mixed stories about different publishers. That's why I was curious. Like they've been on my consciousness for a couple of years now, and I don't know if you've ever heard of Permuted Press. I knew a bunch of them. And then that meltdown and a bunch of other stuff like that. And with the focus that any of these companies have on promotion, the larger companies, what happens is they only do like 95% of their promotions budget to 5% of their authors.
Yes.
So when you look Random House, Penguin, Avon, all those companies, you look at Jonathan Mayberry, he's in the big time. Hello. That wasn't me. No worries. This is live radio. It's what happens.
Yeah.
So he gets promoted heavily by the company, but then they've got 100 other authors, and they may see a little bit of stuff going through. And I think the smaller and medium presses probably spread that out a little bit more, because it's a hit game for them. The more that they can get out there, the more visible and the more that can connect. One of the things that I always say about advertising and marketing and that whole nine yards is the density matrix. The more your name is on, by the way, when I Googled you up today, you actually had a thing pop up on the Google search. Got it?
Yeah, I got it. Sorry.
Your name and thing came up with autofills. So the algorithm is starting to see you. So it has enough of a presence to be able to identify, this is the search pattern I looked for. These are the responses I'm expecting to see. And it's pre-entering that, which is when you're talking about the Amazon algorithm, it's the same thing. It's all about density.
And you know, when I first started this, I had a doctor friend, because I work in a hospital, and I had a doctor friend who has his own pain clinic. And he was telling me that he paid a guy that was able to kind of insert programming so that when anybody searches something, you would pop up first. But if they
SEO wanted, like, optimization.
Yes, but he wanted a lot of money, and I'm like, I don't have the money for that.
Yeah.
But you're right, and you know, one of the things, the reason why I went with a publisher, because I've been doing self-publishing for a while, was that I felt that I wanted somewhere that would hopefully maybe a rising tide raises all ships, right? You know, like if I could get in with the publishing company, and then the publishing company started selling, or somebody in that company did well, you know, even if it was another author, and really rose that up, then I would be on board with that. And hopefully, you know, I'd be like, oh, I'm with Raventail Publishing. And people are like, oh, that's a good, that one is what produced, you know, this really cool author and this really cool series. And then maybe, you know, kind of ride the coattails a little bit on that.
Yeah.
And then I have my own self-publishing stuff. So I'm kind of doing both. I'm playing both angles, you know?
Yeah. Do you ever buy anthology CDs? I love buying anthology CDs.
Yeah. And you can get a lot of the same, you know, connections with that. Yep.
Yep. Totally agree. 100%. Billabong. No, I shouldn't say that, because whatever. It sounded good, though. Well, Marcus, it's been great having you on the show. That hour has just flown by, as it were.
Well, you know, I appreciate you having me. I really do. I had a good time the first time, and I had an even better time this time. So
excellent. Thank you. Now my evil plan comes into play. One of these days I'll start doing video. People are wondering, what the hell is he doing when he does that? Jeebers. Again, thanks for coming on. This episode will become available in the archives hopefully tomorrow. Probably tomorrow. I'll probably do it tomorrow. It won't be today because it's near my bedtime. Not really. But just to everybody out there in After Rot Land, keep coming back every Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or whatever the hell time it is, wherever the hell you are. Find us on the Facebooks, find us on the Instagram, and on the Blue Sky, wherever else we may possibly land our name somewhere. Again, Marcus, thanks for coming back.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And everybody else out there, have yourselves an amazing good time while I find the right button to press when I do this exit.